Okay, we are at 7:31, so I'm going to mute all. And as usual, you'll have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a comment or a question, please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, we will have the contents of the chat and the audio track and the deck will go up on our website. And welcome to all. If we have any new people with us, happy to have guests with us. If you want to join the group, please feel free to do so. We put the URL to where you can join is in the chat window. You can find it on our website. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alan to so everybody's muted. Alan, you'll have to unmute yourself again. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thank you, Chris. And welcome, everyone, as Chris says. And we have a few topics for tonight, so we'll see how far we can get. And we're going to start off with an update from Chris on one of his favorite utilities.
Favorite group of utilities, yeah, the Microsoft Power Toys. So they came out at August 31st with the new versions, 0.73, so they still haven't gotten to version 1 yet. So for anybody who doesn't know about it, Microsoft Power Toys is a group of 22 utilities that add various functionality into Windows. And the version 73 had a lot of bug fixes and enhancements to the existing Power Toys. So even if you're not interested in this one, you might want to pick up the update anyways. So the new Power Toy this release is called Crop and Lock. Next. So to get the Power Toys, if you already have it installed, the easiest way to get the update is to double-click the system tray icon, and then that'll bring up the configuration screen for Power Toys. And on the General tab, there's a button to click for check for updates. Do that, and it'll update automatically to the right version that you're using and so forth. If you don't have the Power Toys installed, you can get them on GitHub, and I will paste that into the chat. And basically, you go to the releases of Power Toys. The latest will be listed at the top all the time. And I highly recommend that you choose the link next to machine-wide x86. So there is user version, which would install it, only available to your user account. I figure it's better just make it, if you have multiple accounts on your computer, go ahead and install the machine-wide one, and then it'll be available to anybody, regardless of how they log on. Next. So what Crop and Lock is all about is it allows you to select part of any window that you have visible on your computer. And then it will display that part that you selected in a smaller window. And one of the neat things about it is that it will be flagged as being always on top. So no matter what you have going on your computer, this will always float on the top where it will be visible. Next. There's two modes that the window can actually act in. One is thumbnail. These are Microsoft Power Toys terms for it. I don't think they really make all that much sense, but thumbnail. And for that, you can't interact with that window that is opened up and is always on top. So you can just see it. But it will show changes within the application window. So if you had a video playing or something like that, it would be updated. And if whatever else is going on in that particular window, if that application, if it changes the display window, the portion that you've captured will be updated in real time. The other one is called Reparent, and it allows you to, as I say, sometimes interact with the program that has been captured. In actual fact, most of the time you can, but it's a bit of a crapshoot as to which programs will work and which won't. So it allows you to scroll vertically in the captured window just using the mouse wheel. You can't use your keyboard or anything like that. And there is no way to scroll horizontally, even if you have a mouse wheel that can go sideways. But you can edit, select visible menu options that are in showing up in that little window, copy it to the clipboard and things like that. They actually admit that it's an experimental feature and that they say might cause issues with some applications. It doesn't actually cause issues with the application. The application continues working fine. what it may cause issues with is that captured window that is sitting there always on top. So it may stop responding or not act properly. Next. So say I'm working in a document here. So I have a Word document up and I need some information from a website to complete this document. Next. So I can bring up my browser window and find the web page with the information that I actually want. And then next. I can do a marquee select around the portion of that window that I actually want, and then press the hotkey for crop and lock. And in this case, I'm in the reparent option, and it'll capture that window, and that window will then float on top. Next. So there is where that window that I captured, and it's floating on top of my document that I'm editing. Next. So I can move that window around. So if I'm editing a document, it may be sitting over top of a part of the document that I actually want to edit. So you can move it around. So I can switch the focus to Word just by clicking on the Word document and go ahead and edit. And then the captured window remains above it where I can refer to that information as I'm editing my document. Next. And then I can use the mouse wheel to scroll the contents of that captured window. So if it's a very small window, it's just got some of the information, I can scroll it so I can see more information and continue to work on my document. Next. And then when you want, you can close the captured window when you're done with it by just clicking the X in that, and then everything will be back to normal. Next. So Microsoft says it's a work in progress. Well, I say it's a work in progress. I think they'll admit to the fact that it's a work in progress as well. I find that it's not a bad solution when you have some text showing in a program that you want to refer to while you're working in some other program. I think that there are significant issues with this initial release, though. Next. The thumbnail mode is pretty stable, so it seems to work very reliably. Everything will display properly, but you don't get to interact with the captured program at all. Next. The reparent mode, I'm hoping that they're going to do some work on this and make it more stable. So it's much more functional, but it's also more problematic in the initial release. So some Windows Store apps don't display at all, so you just get a blank box. Some programs allow interaction, so things like editing, selecting menus, and so forth, that you can see within that window. But I found that some programs, after you use it a little bit and you start interacting with it a little bit, they start to, I call it, get confused. So basically they stop being interactable. So you can no longer scroll in it. You can no longer activate menu options that you can see in it and things like that. Next. So I'm hoping that this will actually improve over time. I would like to see horizontal scrolling implemented in it. I'd like to see more reliable interaction with the program when you're in reparent mode. And I would like the ability to resize that captured window, which currently you can't. So all of those sort of things I hope will be improved. Now, I'll say one thing, that there's another utility, and the PowerToys actually has an always-on top PowerToy, where you can do a similar action, where you can just say, okay, this window that I've got here of my web browser, I want it to float above Word even while I'm working in Word, rather than Word taking over and being on top of the web browser. The difference in that is that the always on top will ensure that your entire web browser, or whatever it is that you want to refer to, is always on top rather than just a small window portion of it. So I think in many cases, I don't want to see the whole web browser. I just want to see a portion of it. I don't necessarily want to resize my browser window down to a smaller size. It just means that I have to resize it back up afterwards and so forth. So I think these are pretty complementary utilities. And so I'm hoping that this particular utility will get better over time. And that's all I have for now.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And for those who don't know much about power toys, if you check the chat window, Tristan has put in a link to a YouTube video, which he says is a nice breakdown of all the tools available in power toys. And Chris, Tom is suggesting, I think, with regard to cutting and pasting, attach a second old monitor.
Yeah. Hey, more screen, desktop real estate is always a solution for sure.
Okay, thanks very much. And moving along, we have part two of Linda's series on photo editing.
Okay, thanks.
Oh, so, a second, Linda, I just realized I didn't make you a co-host yet.
Okay, and if I don't know if you still there have you the link handy for Photoscape X, because there could be people that weren't able to attend part one and I didn't resend it to you. So if it's handy, great. If not, it's on the part one deck.
It's pasted in now.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so tonight we're going to talk about lighting adjustments, and I just want to show you how you can really drastically improve photos with just a few quick clicks in Photoscape X. Next.
I don't have any slides, Linda.
Oh, okay. Well, I do. All right. Well, the next slide was, I'm going to demo it anyway, so let's just go right into the demo. No point looking at any more slides.
Yeah, by PowerPoint.
Okay, so I've opened up Photoscape X. Can everybody see that okay?
Yep.
All right. So the first photo I'm going to bring in is just you drag your photo and drop it into the work area. And this is this shot that I took while we were in Iceland. And it's lovely, but it's a little sort of bland looking, I find. A little flat. I'll call it flat. So I'm just going to move this over. Collapse everybody. Okay. So the best way to improve a photo like this is not to saturate it. That's often people's first instinct. Oh, I'll just make the reds redder and I'll make the greens greener. That can look really fake really fast. So go to this color tab, which is where we're going to find all our lighting adjustments. If you go to the lighting tab for lighting adjustments, you're going to be disappointed because it's just some weird flares and hearts that I don't need in my photo. So the color tab has all the lighting adjustments and all the color adjustments and more, every individual colors, etc. So this is the tab that you go to for either color or light. So in this instance, the easiest way to improve this photo really quickly is to add contrast. And I'm showing the histogram down here at the bottom, which you'll remember is a distribution of your pixels. So on the left side, those are your pure black. The right side are your pure white. And you can see by this histogram, we don't have any pure black and pure white, and that's why it looks a little flat. If I take this contrast bar, click on it, and just drag it to the right, all of a sudden, everything becomes more intense. I did not saturate it. I just increased the contrast, okay? So that's just a real quick demonstration for this particular photo where it worked really, really well. Had I saturated it, you get that effect where it just starts to look phony. You see that on the internet all the time, and I just detest it. Okay, so the next one I want to show you is going to talk about contrast as well, but we're going to see a different kind of situation. So we're going to go into color because I find this one a little flat too. We're going to add the contrast, but watch what happens to the histogram. So when I add that contrast, that's great. Gave me pure black, got nothing on the pure white. So this contrast button is a bit of a blunt instrument in that I can't guide, one side of it versus the other. But I can if I go down to more. So I'm going to leave the contrast where it was, and I'm going to click on more. And more gives me the ability to drag individually my black slider and my white slider. So the black, we don't have too much further to go to the left on the histogram, but we're going to drag the black a little over. So it's kind of right up against. That looks pretty good. And now we're going to drag the white, and that's going to add a lot of brightness and lightness to our photo. And that's where you get that feel of the sun coming through. So I'm just going to do the compare so you can just drag this across, and you can see how we've just popped that out, and strictly just by moving the black and white bars. Okay, so the next example I want to show you is this one. So here's a picture of the Ottawa River, and I kind of want to lighten the log so it doesn't look like a big turd in the middle of the Ottawa River. So I'm trying to make it look like a log. And so we'll go into the color tab to lighten. Now, if I brighten everything overall, that'll make it look like a log, but I've lost, you know, the color of the sunrise. So the best thing to do in this situation is to use this first tab called Light and Shadows, because you see how much is black in this image. So I'm just going to drag that over and see how far I have to go. So not too far. It now looks like a log, and I haven't lost that much color. Of course, it's going to lighten any shadows that you have in your sunrise, but it's not too bad. So you can just trade off, and we could mask it, and we're going to do that in a couple of weeks. But just to use that little light and shadows can be very helpful. Okay, the next image I'm going to show, we are going to get to HDR. I just want to promise those who are interested in HDR, we are going to get there, but I'm just going to do a few first here. So this is a situation where you can use both light and shadows and dark and highlight. So in this case, I'm kind of a bit in the shadow. My face is quite dark. My lap is dark, that area, my body's dark. So we're going to lighten the shadows on me. That looks a lot better. But then, you know, we're pretty washed out in the back here with the snow. So we can do the same. We can use these at the same time. We can darken highlights. So I'm going to darken the highlights. Now you can see the trees better in the background. So I'm just going to do a quick before, and there's the after. So again, really quick. These are just, you know, casual photos, but so often we're taking family photos, somebody sitting in front of a window. It just happens. That's how we arrange our furniture. So a very quick, handy thing to have. Okay, I'm going to cancel out of that. So now we're going to go to an HDR situation. So HDR just means high dynamic range. So we have this photo that I took at the river where the gentleman and his boat are quite dark in the shadows, but there is a nice little pink sunset that I don't want to lose. So if I go into color, I'll show you what happens. Before I show you the nifty HDR button, I'm going to do it as I would have done it in the image before. So let's say we lighten shadows to see more of the gentleman and the mist, because I want that mist white, a little bit whiter, not so much gray. So that's not looking too bad. But of course, I've lost my pink. If we do a compare, you can see I've lost that pink in the sunrise. Well, let's darken highlights like we did in the previous photo with the snow. So I'm going to darken the highlights right over, and I'm going to lighten the shadows right over. Well, that looks okay till I scroll in, and you'll see there's this haloing that happens. Anytime you use light and shadow and darken highlights, you risk having this haloing that looks quite unnatural. Okay, and you can go in and mask it and darken it. It's a pain. It's a lot of work. So that's the reason that I usually don't always use those two in combination. It didn't cause any problems with the picture of me with the dog, but it is causing problems here. But what I'm going to show you is that for some reason or another, even though a high dynamic range button here, I know it's doing this kind of thing, lightening shadows and darkening highlights. This is on the home screen on the edit tab, just on the home where we had our crop. I'm going to hit that HDR, and look what a great job it did. It lightened the gentleman. It lightened my mist. It didn't lighten my sky too much. And when I zoom in, there's no haloing. So good on them. Now, it doesn't always work, but it's sure worth a try if you've got a situation like this. So I'm going to hit, and don't forget, this is free software, so I was pretty impressed. So I'm going to hit apply. And then, of course, I would just, you know, crop it to maybe include his reflection, make sure he's getting kind of close to the rule of thirds where we talked about sort of putting people in that those intersection areas. Crop it, and you can always go back to your original. We still haven't saved it. You can always go back to your original on this homepage and go before and after. So much better. Okay, now we're going to talk about two more images if there's time, and I'll let Alan interrupt me if I go on too long. So this one here is a situation where I've got a picture of Chris here from PEI, but when I looked at the image, I wasn't really struck on the colors, so I decided to put it in black and white. So how you do this is you go to the color tab, and you can't just completely desaturate. You just drag your saturation over to -100 and it becomes black and white. And you can see by the histogram, there's no red, green. It's just black and white. Now you can also see I have no pure white and I have no pure black. So again, it looks very flat and you could adjust that with the black and white bars. But you can also just start out, if you want to, you can start out with an overall tab at the top here, which allows you to do a grayscale. I wouldn't go to black and white. It's usually very contrasty like that. So not my first choice, but the grayscale looks really nice. And then I check the histogram. It's not that much different from desaturating, but sometimes it's a little better. It just depends on the image. So now I would go into my more and I would adjust my black, drag it over to the edge of my histogram, just my white, make sure I don't go too far and have anything overexposed. And now I've got a nice balanced image, and you could crop or whatever. So if you want to do an image in black and white, that's the best route to do with this program. Okay, the last image I'm going to show you is just kind of, it's not a great image. It's more to show you that you can do some photo rescuing with not too many steps. So let's just review what we did last time. So first of all, it's crooked, so we're going to hit our straighten button, and we're going to straighten it to the horizon a little bit, okay, and get him looking pretty flat there. Then we're going to, it's clearly too much on the right here. It's overexposed. I'm going to darken the highlights on this, but you could, because I don't want him too silhouetted, but you could just touch the black maybe a bit, but we don't want to lose his color of his shirt and the bit of face and skin that we can see. It's kind of nice he's not silhouetted. Sun's a little blasted out, so I'd probably just crop most of that out, and I might just give the suggestion of a little bit of light coming through my image. Maybe put him over a little, I don't want him centered, so drag him over just a little bit, have a little bit of that light come through and do it like that. So yeah, not the best image in the whole wide world, but I think a big improvement over the original. So that's all I was going to cover tonight. I'm happy to answer questions.
Nothing okay. In the chat at this point.
Okay. So I will stop the share then and put it back to you guys.
Thanks, Linda.
Okay,
thanks very much, Linda. Okay, so moving along, I have a share now on a program called BleachBit. Now this was suggested by a member who will remain anonymous. It turns out this program didn't work out too well, so I don't want Stuart to get upset with me. I have actually used this program previously. It's actually a Linux program, but it was suggested I try it in Windows, so I did so. And the idea is it's it's one of these file manager type programs or finding free disk space type programs. And it says it will clear cache and cookies and internet history and logs and junk you didn't even know was there. And that's certainly true. It finds files that you probably don't know was there. It has some other features such as shredding and wiping free disk space. So that's overwriting deleted files with zeros to make like a secure erase type function. And other utilities that do that. And if you check the newsletter, Chris highlighted a couple of programs that will do secure erase. As I said, I like it. I use this program because it's multi-platform. So I've used it on Linux for trying to clean up my system when I was running out of disk space. But it's also available for Windows. And the developer says it's better than free. And it's open source. And open source generally is a pretty good deal in my view. However, this one falls short in my opinion. two things are a problem with it. The first one is this. When you go to the website, you'll find there's lots of adverts and there's great big buttons telling you to download the software. But the trouble is the download buttons have got absolutely nothing to do with the BleachBit. It's downloading software, presumably, which he's getting paid for to promote on his website. And even when you go to this download link on the menu here, the first thing you see is a great big download now button, which suggests it's for Windows 10. But again, it's not BleachBit. If you look carefully here, it's something to do with a PC app store. So it's actually nothing to do with BleachBit. So you have to scroll down the page until you can find this tiny little link down the bottom here, where you can actually download the installation package for either Linux or Windows. And eventually, you will get to a choice of the installer, the EXE version for Windows, or there's actually a portable version as well. But if you're interested in trying BleachBit out, make sure that you get to this dialog box, where you can see that you're actually getting the BleachBit EXE, the installation file. All right, so that's the first problem, is actually trying to find the software to download. And then after that, it gets a little bit better, but it's still confusing. So you install the program, and you run it, and you see this screen right here, which on my monitor, I couldn't tell much in terms of the contrast between the red text and the black background. It doesn't really help me very much. However, I did find the settings menu, and if you go to the settings menu, which is this button in the top left-hand corner here, and go down to preferences and find the general tab, and you will find that dark mode is set as the option, the default option. So you uncheck dark mode, and you'll be able to see what's going on. All right, so now you've got a whole bunch of red text, which is a bad sign. It means something's not happening. And really the problem is that we haven't told it to do anything. We need to check some of these boxes to make things happen. And when you start checking the boxes, you'll find a bunch of things occur. One of the things it will tell you is when you hit the system box, it says that various subcategories on the system are very slow. So here's one where it's offering to wipe the free disk space, which will be a slow option because there'll be lots of it and it takes a while. And really there's no point in doing that unless you're terribly concerned about leaving files on your disk which you've deleted. But they're going to get overwritten anyway eventually, so unless you're really concerned, that shouldn't be an option. So that can be slow. However, more concerning are things like this. When I check the Thunderbird box, it tells me if I leave the index button checked, deleting the index is also going to reset the configuration of the message columns. Now, I use a custom setup, so I've set up all the columns exactly the way I want them. I don't want to have this program basically overwrite all the good work that I've done. So you've got to be careful when you're selecting things. So here's an example where I checked the system button, but then I've unchecked free disk space because I don't want to overwrite the free disk space. It doesn't do me any good. So to run BleachBit, my preferences were as follows. I disabled the free disk space. Under Thunderbird, I stopped it playing with the index because that was going to reset the columns. I stopped it playing with the passwords because that was going to delete any passwords which I had saved. And I do actually save passwords in Thunderbird, so I don't have to enter passwords just to get my email. It does it automatically. And then another one, under the Windows Explorer category, there's a category called Shellbacks, which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. However, if you leave that one checked, what it does is it will make the desktop icons go to some kind of default state. And again, I set my Windows desktop, I set it up the way I want it. I actually use a utility to maintain those positions so I can always restore them. But again, I don't want a third party program coming in and changing everything that I've done. Right. So those are the things which I turned off before I did anything. And the other thing I did before I did anything was to make a full backup disk image, because it's going to go in and delete a whole bunch of stuff. And I know what categories it's going to delete, but I don't really know what the files are. And there's so many of them, I wouldn't want to check them all out individually anyway. So my plan here is make a backup disk image, run the program. If anything doesn't work, I can always do a restore, and I'll be back in business very quickly. Okay, so here we are. I've got a bunch of stuff checked. Here's an interesting one. There's a category for Firefox, and a whole bunch of things are checked there. The only problem is, on my system, I don't have Firefox installed, so I'm not quite sure why BleachBit decided that should be a good category. Presumably because it's a Linux-based program as well, and Firefox is the default browser for a lot of Linux distros. But since I don't have it installed, it's actually not going to do me any good. But I don't think it told me it was trying to find any free space in that category, so it was probably okay anyway. And then eventually we get down to the ones that have some space to get rid of, and it's mostly this 1.4 gigabytes almost in system here. And so it's going to recover about 1.4, just under 1.4 gig. It's going to delete 4,000 files, and it has six special operations, whatever six special operations are. And this is a preview, right? I've checked the preview button, and it's gone through, and it's telling me what it's going to do. So now if I actually want to have it do it, I have to press this clean button, and off it will go. And sure enough, it gives me one more option. Are you sure you want to do this? Because now we literally are going to delete all these files, which it says it wants to. But you notice I've turned off index, I've turned off passwords, I've turned off shell bags, and so forth. So we let it run, and it says it's really interesting mathematics again here. It had 1.4 gigabytes about to recover, and it's managed to recover 2.05 gigabytes, which is quite remarkable. It's deleted 14,000 files. I think it had 4,000 files before. 67 special operations now, but it has 18 errors. And when you scroll up this list on the right here, you find that all the errors are to do with Microsoft folders. And here's a bunch of them: Microsoft Windows Defender. Microsoft Windows wouldn't let BleachBit delete all these files right here, presumably because these are files which are in use right now, and Windows is not happy to have it delete things. Anyway, those are the numbers which BleachBit says it did. Here's what actually happened. Before I did anything, I checked, and I had 10.7 gigabytes free on this hard drive. And when the smoke cleared, I had 12.4, so my math says that's 1.7, I think it is. So 1.7 gigs. So it's kind of in between what it said it was going to do, what it thought it had done, and what it actually did. And I don't know what this one is. All right. So here's the other thing that I always look at, is that disk cleanup. So if I run disk cleanup after I run BleachBit, it turns out BleachBit didn't find 3 gig in Windows Update cleanup, for example, and 139 meg in the regular disk cleanup. So it does a whole bunch of stuff. It doesn't do some things. So it can find a lot of files. However, you really have to pay attention when you're selecting the categories, because it may do things that you actually don't want it to do. And here's another application. We looked at PC Manager before, where we were trying to clean stuff up, and they do clean stuff up, but it still leaves things sitting around, and whatever I do, I seem to have to run this cleanup. The other thing that I don't like about this program, I don't like about the Windows version of this program, apart from all these crazy things which you have to check. I decided I'd write this up as an article for the newsletter because they're running short of articles. So I ran this bleach bit again so I could make some screenshots. And everything was fine and dandy until I inadvertently left that this space cleanup, the shredding thing, I left that checked. So sure enough, it was taking forever and it wasn't really getting anywhere. So I hit the abort button. You remember it has preview, it has cleanup, and it also has abort. So I thought, well, I'll just stop it. I'll reset the categories and I'll let it run again. So I aborted it. I unchecked the disk space cleanup, set it going again, and it never completed. And then I found I tried to close it down. I couldn't close it down. It was sitting in the taskbar doing nothing. I couldn't load Windows Task Manager to turn everything off or to turn Bleach Bit off. And so I ended up, I couldn't do anything. The thing was hung basically. So I ended up pressing the red power button and holding it down for 10 seconds and starting over. And you remember that disk image I made? The next thing I did was to restore my disk drive to the point before I ran BleachBit, uninstall BleachBit, and now everything is once again good. So, although it's a free program, although it's open source, I'm afraid I can't actually recommend it because it didn't work for me. Now, that may be a one-off type of thing, I really don't know, but it's a kind of a black box. It's hard to know what it's doing. It's complex to figure out what it wants to do, what you want it to do. And to me, there's just too many bits and pieces to worry about. I'm sure there are better ways to clean up your hard drive than running BleachBit. So, for what it's worth, there it is, but I don't actually recommend it.
Okay, we have a comment from or a question from Tom said, could disk space discrepancies be due to some files being compressed?
No idea. Could be.
And I had a question actually too on the when you got all the error messages. You usually run as a standard user, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. So you didn't run this with administrator privileges?
No.
Okay.
No, thanks,
so that
unless...
could be. Why unless,
I can't remember, Chris, when you run BleachBit, you may have to do a UAC and give it admin privileges.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I'll bet
and
you
then,
do.
And then we also had a question from Ed. How does this compare to CCleaner? I guess CCleaner
well,
is more reliable.
I think you can probably answer that. It's very similar, right?
Yeah, it's similar, but all these disk cleanup utilities, I find, they all do a little bit different things. And so some will be better at some things than others. I use CCleaner on a regular basis, and I find it very useful because it can go in and clean caches from all your browsers in one fell swoop, things like that. So personally, I find CCleaner to be a very, very useful tool. But in almost all cases, you're going to find that any of these tools will do something that none of the other ones happen to do. So as Alan finds with the disk cleanup utility that is built into Windows, they found gigabytes that BleachBit wouldn't deal with, you know, and things like that. So, yeah, bit of a crapshoot.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, Chris has got a new share here on disposable email addresses, which actually comes from Jeff.
Yeah, Jeff sent in this as a suggestion, and the idea behind disposable email addresses is that there's sometimes when you don't want to give somebody your email address, but it is needed for a particular purpose. So I find that this happens quite often when you have to send a valid, you're on a website and you want to use one of the services and they say, enter your email address and we'll send you, to make sure you are who you are, say you are. And then we'll send you a link in that, and then you have to click on that to validate it, that you're a real person and that sort of idea. Well, you know, do you really trust this random website that you happen to come across? Maybe, maybe not. Or you just don't, you know, have an initial trust of a person or service, and you really want to see if there's going to be a negative effect to providing them your email address. Next. So this was a site that Jeff actually recommended or mentioned about, and it's called TempMail, and I pasted the URL into the chat on this. So when you go to the website, it comes up like this, and next. You might want to use an ad blocker when you're using that site, because you see it's the information that's of any importance is surrounded by ads. Next. Whereas with an ad blocker, well, that's a little bit nicer. Next. So when you go to the site, you will automatically get an email address generated for you into the top box. And if you open and close, you close your browser, reopen it, go back to the site, you'll get the same address generated. But it is stored in a cookie. So if you load a different web browser, it will actually generate a different email address, because the email address they generate gets stored in a cookie, so that if you reload your browser, you end up getting the same one. I took a look at the cookies, and cookies are a little bit funny because a lot of the information is either obscured or encrypted. But there were two tokens within it that looked like they might have something to do with the expiration of the address. The expiry dates for the tokens were, one of them was 1 week and one of them was 1 year. I'm assuming that at least one of those tokens would be for the expiration of the address, so you would automatically get a new one, but I'm not even 100% sure of that. So the temporary email address might expire in a week, might expire in a year, or might never expire as long as you use the same browser. Next. So, yeah, if there is a green button there that you can use to copy the address they've generated for you to the clipboard, so that you can paste it into whatever it is that you're trying to use this email address. Next. And then any emails that get sent to that address appear in the lower box. Now, it's only on this website. You can't have it redirected to your personal email or anything like that. If you want to see any emails that get sent to that address, you actually have to go and look at them on this particular website. Next.
Chris, there's a note here from Jeff. He says the email address expired in a week.
Yeah, I sort of suspected that that was going to be the case, but I went and did something that I messed up my cookies on it, so I couldn't validate it, and I didn't feel like going back later and redoing the tests and wait for a week. So good to know. Thanks, Tim. Okay, so there are some other controls in there. There is a button to do a change, and what that is designed to do is that it'll allow for the recovery of an old temporary email address you got through the site. But it is only available on premium, and I was not about to pay for premium to validate that's really what it does, because premium goes for the low, low price of $10 US per month, or you can get it for $60 US per year. It's an awful lot to be able to get a temporary email address. So I wasn't about to pay for it just to test out that feature. Next. There is an option there called delete, and what it will do is it will immediately invalidate that temporary email address that you were given, and it'll automatically generate a new one for you. Once an email address is invalidated, anybody sending to that address, it will go nowhere, and they will not get a non-delivery report. So they are, technically, they're not following the RFCs for email. Because if you don't deliver an email, you're supposed to send back a non-delivery report. So just realize that if you do invalidate it, the sender who sends to that address will not know, and they will probably send to that address. If they're a spammer, they'll send to that address forever, and it'll just go nowhere. Next. Okay, again, this Jeff has come up with the answer to this, that it will remain valid for a week. And but an important thing on it is that those received emails that come into the lower box, they disappear after 2 hours. So if, for example, you do some validation thing on a website and then you go to bed and you get up in the morning and you look and there's no reply from them or anything like that, it could have come in and just disappeared to within the two hour window. So not terribly great that way. Next. So do I care if the email address remains valid? I might if I decide that I do trust this person to a certain extent, but I don't want to go through the trouble of telling them, well, I really lied and this is my real email address. You know, I might actually want that email address to remain valid. I don't know. Do I care if the emails disappear? Again, that depends. You know, like they are only going to appear there for two hours. If I know that, maybe that's long enough for me to have those emails stick there, but maybe not. So sort of your mileage may vary. Next. They have another site or another web page within that site called 10 Minute Mail. And this is, if you really want that email address to be temporary, this will bring up a new email address. Next. And then a countdown timer starts. And it starts at 10. You can see this is at 9:28 and it's counting down. And when it gets to zero, it'll automatically invalidate that email address and give you a new one automatically. So I don't know really why you would necessarily want this over top of the previous example. But yeah, if you really want it to be a temporary email address, 10 minutes validation on it, you can actually do that as well. Next. Okay, looking back at the site itself, it's got some pretty bad English on the site. And I get concerned anytime a website claims to be sending English to me and they can't speak English. So here's a couple of examples they had. Recently, I found a bounce rate complex that usual on my latest email blast, whatever that means. Or the fake email address is simply a throwaway email, temporary email set and self-destructs email. You know, so it bothers me a little bit on that, but you know, it may not indicate anything bad. It is a free service after all, but it's obvious that the person who set up this website, their first language is not English, which may not be a bad thing, but it just struck me. Next. Now, if you really want temporary email addresses, National Capital Freenet has a way, way better system for disposable email addresses, totally under your control. Right on the start page, you'll see in the left-hand box under email, there's a link for disposable email address. Next. So if you go to that, it brings up another dialog box or another web page, and it allows you to create a new email alias that it can be disposable if you want it to be disposed of at some point. So you go and you put in a prefix. In this case, I put in Sam Spade Canada, and you can put in a description. So if you have multiple ones, you can say, okay, this was used for the following purpose, and you can then relate it back and decide whether you want to do away with it later on or deal with it differently or something like that. So it's kind of nice to be able to tie a description to that temporary email address. Next. You click on generate an alias, and next. And then truly is a prefix that you put in there, because it will automatically add in a dot and a whole bunch of letters and numbers at ncf.ca. I believe that what they generate for you, like in this case is BPU9Z, that will be unique per user. All of the temporary addresses that they call them disposable email addresses, they added in that exact same dot. BPU9Z. So I suspect that that's unique to me, but you will end up with something that is, recognizable like that. Next. If you decide you no longer need one of these disposable email addresses, you can get rid of it, delete, and away it'll go. And my understanding is that these will actually get NDRs, non-delivery reports, if people send to it at a later date. Next. Okay, so let's look at how this works in practice. So we had a nefarious character called Chris Taylor, and he sent to sansbaycanada.whatever it is at ncf.ca, so the disposable email address. So I receive that email address. And one of the neat things is it comes into my regular email. Okay. Next. And the two on it will actually display the disposable email address rather than saying it's to Chris Taylor. Next. So what can you do to handle this particular type of email? So I don't necessarily want it to come into with all my other mail, where it'll just sort of get mixed in with it all. I won't recognize that this is something that actually came to the disposable email address rather than to my personal email address. So I can create a filter. Next. So all I have to do is go into the filter and I set the parameters, the two contains, and I just put in the disposable email address or something unique about that. So I just did SoundScape Canada. So there's only one disposable email address that I have that will have SoundScape Canada in it. Next. And then I told it to move it to a folder and I moved it to a folder called SoundScape. So I would, in this example, just create a folder for each of the disposable email addresses that I've got, and any of the email that comes in will go, get categorized into those folders so I can deal with them separately. Next. So when you're replying to such an email, and this is one of the reasons why I really want it to go into a separate folder, because if I just happen to see an email in my inbox and I do a reply, the reply is going to come from my primary email address. So I've just sort of defeated the whole purpose of having a disposable email address because I've exposed to the person exactly what my real email address is. Next. So what you can do is you can go on the from and you can click on the down pointing triangle and it'll come up with your primary email address as well as all your disposable email addresses will be listed as well. So I can change the from to be my SoundScape Canada, you know, at NCF. Next. And through that, I won't be exposing my email address to the spammer or whatever it is that I'm trying to deal with. So what I really like about the NCF method of doing this is that your the mail that gets sent to that disposable email address gets delivered to my regular mailbox. I can deal with it as I want. I can keep it forever. I can delete it. I can whatever I would do with my regular email. It is easily identifiable by who the email was addressed to. And because of that, I can move it with rules so that I don't accidentally forget that, oh, this is an email that was sent to my disposable email address. So it's more identifiable. Plus, it's being kept out of my face so that I don't have to deal with them if I don't want to. When you do a reply, if you do a reply, you can actually have the reply come from the disposable email address, ensuring that you don't expose your real email address to it. Next. You can also get rid of the disposable email addresses quickly and easily if you decide you no longer need them, or you can keep them around forever. So you can just decide, well, this person that I now trust to get mail, well, do I really care if it comes to, you know, Chris Taylor or it comes to, you know, Sand State or whatever. I don't, you know, I could just leave it there forever and just leave it. Next. Another thing, you can have as many disposable email addresses as you want. I don't know if there's a limit, but I know you can create lots. I like it that the service won't disappear. NCF has been around for a long, long time. I expect that they're going to be around for a lot, lot longer. And this service has been there for a long time. It's great. It works. It might be your greatest $15 per year investment. And the $15 comes from the recommendation that be the donation for your membership with email if you're just joining the NCF. Strictly speaking, you don't actually have to pay NCF anything. You can get an account and you can say, no, I don't want to pay anything. And they will set you up in an account. But it does cost them something to run their infrastructure and things like that. So I think $15 a year for an NCF membership, it's great to have another email address. There's a bunch of other services. You can get web pages, website through them, so forth. But you can also get it with this disposable email addresses for $15 a year. I think it's a pretty good investment. And that's all I have to say on that.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. One question I have, when you say you the different options for dealing with the incoming email, you can save it to folders. Could you also forward it to another email provider?
Yeah. Anything that the rules allow you to do can apply to this as well. So yeah, forwarding to another email address is definitely a doable thing.
There's also a browser extension for Chrome and for Firefox called DuckDuckGo Privacy Essentials, and that includes a disposable or a reusable email address at duck.com that will last forever. It forwards to your email address automatically, and on the forwards, it deletes all the tracking pixels and stuff like that that goes along with it. It's well worth investigating. DuckDuckGo also has Essentials, also has a whole bunch of other privacy protecting stuff in it. And
one of the problems with doing that is that when it gets forwarded, if you want to reply to it, it becomes more difficult to reply with the disposable email address as the from.
You can always put that in your from as well in most email programs. You don't have to go with your own thing. At least I have no problems with it with Pegasus Mail, but I believe that you can override that in most mail programs like Thunderbird and other things. Maybe not in Google Mail or Gmail, but most of the POPs free programs, you can specify the reply to and the from separately. There is another header put in there saying it actually got sent from tom@evercurio.com. But the reply and from headers are reset.
Yeah, it's just that to change those, especially if you have multiple of these, that you set it up and then, you know, you just want to do it once. It's not just to click on the drop down on the from and select it. It's a matter of going into the configuration and saying, okay, I want to set up a from that is a different email address on it. So it tends to be a little bit more tedious than...
Not at all, because certainly in Pegasus Mail, and I imagine other email programs, you can actually specify in the email the from on a particular email, and it's easy to copy the from because usually you're replying to another message that's there, and you can copy the from that and put it in.
If anybody's doing this, test it before you count on it, because I know this could be fairly easy to have it, from Sam Spade on behalf of or something like that ends up where the email is actually coming from and so forth. So, if you're forwarding to another email address and you reply, be careful.
Thanks, Chris. Jocelyn has put in the URL for NCF if anyone wants to check that out. And Elizabeth comments that NCF is great, with the exception that the mobile version of Zimbra, which I guess must be the email client, does not allow for attachments.
Oh, that's interesting.
But presumably you could use a different client.
I mean, it's normally just a web interface. So if you just load up a standard web browser, I didn't know they had a different client for mobile. But you should be able to do it just through a regular browser, and it would give you the same interface as if you're on your desktop, I would have thought, but not 100% sure.
I'll try that out. That I know that I've had, for years I've complained about that, and when I do want to use an attachment, I go to my desktop version.
Yeah. So the NCF, do they actually have a mobile client?
Well, they have a thin client. It's called a thin client or something like that.
I would just try a regular web browser on your mobile device and go to NCF. Now, it might be kind of ugly in the way that, you know, it positions things on a smaller screen. It might be, you know, totally unusable on a mobile size screen, but it might be worth trying.
I think the problem would be that how do you attach the attachment? Most attachments, in fact, are going to be pictures, and you can do a share with a picture, but can you have that share go to a browser and show up in the email window? I doubt it.
Well, if it would be the same as on the desktop. If the Zimbra client on desktop is just a web page, and so it would be the same thing on mobile. You'd just be getting a web page.
Well, I know, but about Gmail and other and WhatsApp, you can just share it directly, and it goes there because you have a mail program on your phone. But if it's a web page, then it may or may not work. I would suggest that if you have a thin client, then maybe it would work if Zimbra supports that, which the previous talker said it didn't. So yeah. I think that it just makes it more awkward. And I would suggest pictures are probably 99% of the attachments you want to make.
Well, but you could also use a different client. I mean, for example, I use K9, and K9 handles attached files no problem at all.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see if we can. Yes. Right, so we're at the witching hour. We're a minute over, actually. And if anybody has any other questions or comments, Jeff says the original NCF used RoundCube Mail and changed to Zimbra a number of years ago. K9 should talk to the NCF mail server with no problem at all. I would think that's true. I use K9 on my own mail server and also on Gmail, so it works fine for both those.
Yeah, anything that's either POP or IMAP should be able to talk to their servers, no problem.
Yeah. Tom says maybe copy and pasting a photo would work.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've had our hour. Thank you very much, everybody. And to wrap up, I've got a couple of public service announcements. First of all, you'll notice that tonight there were absolutely no questions. That's because nobody sent any questions in. We did have an additional share, but we don't have time for it, so we'll postpone that until next week. But basically, what we need to know, what Chris and I need to know especially, is what do you need to know? Anything about hardware items, operating systems, applications, smartphones, tablets, Linux, Android, whatever, anything that's to do with computers. If you don't know the answer, maybe somebody in the club does, and if you ask us, we can probably find an answer for you. So as usual, all questions and comments to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. I did mention earlier that I thought there were very few articles in the pipe for the newsletter. So if you have an inkling to be an author, now is your chance. I'm sure Bridget, our hardworking editor, would love to hear from anybody who has a computer-related article. Same kind of deal. Anything on hardware or software, anything that's got to do with computers, and you write an original article, Bridget would be happy to hear from you. And we'll be happy to hear from you because next week we have another Q&A session on Wednesday the 27th. And right now we have one item in the pipe. So if you have questions or topics that you'd like to share with the group, please let us know. And otherwise, we'll see you all next week. Thanks very much for attending.